Welcome all to listen visiting lecture In Search of Wise Leadership, Implications for Teaching and Learning. It has been a great pleasure to have a distinguished Professor Erik Kessler as visiting fellow in the Finnish Institute for Educational Research in our Wisdom and Learning Research team. He comes from Pace University, Lewin School of Business, New York, USA, and his main interests have been in the fields of leadership and wisdom research. This presentation will be recorded and to be found later on our research team's webpage. I'm now looking forward to hear your perspective and deeply insightful thoughts and reflections. The floor is yours, Erik.
The floor is mine.
Yes.
How nice. Thank you and welcome today on this beautiful winter Wednesday. Yes? Good. I got something right. That's good to start out on right foot to talk about In Search of Wise Leadership and maybe what we can glean from it for teaching and learning. It's a pleasure to be with you. Most of you I know are online. It's nice to start a presentation when a new virus emerges, but notwithstanding, I want to welcome you and start out this presentation like I do all my presentations and quite frankly how I think all presentations should be begun, with a warm thank you. Thank you for being here. I know you have a lot of things to do. You have lives. We all have lives and things on our mind, but what I will try and do is make it worth your time. And as I'm an explorer, seeking what wisdom means and how we can use it to better our institutions and our lives, both personally and professionally. As I walk it, I am warmed by your company. So thanks for being here. I'd like to begin my talk by telling you what I'm going to talk about. And first, I want to show you why I think it's worth your time to give you, as I say in my business classes, your money's worth. So let me speak in the beginning to why we need wise leadership. I don't think this is going to be a difficult sell. The problem that we face, the journey that we've taken, and a solution that maybe we're getting closer to. And I apologize to you in advance. If you've come looking for simple answers, there aren't any. Or if there are, I don't have them. But what I think we are on the brink of, what I think we are moving towards, is a path, is a way, is a process to see how we can understand what wise leadership is and to cultivate it in ourselves and hopefully institutionalize it so it lives beyond us. And I will present that model to you. I will present that model of what it means to be more wise and how we can become more wise. And I'll tip you off. There are three dialectics involved. One's about how to be better, to see better, and to do better. And then finally, and integrated therein, I'll speak to teaching and learning, because I know much of our audience is from this background. So how, if we know what wise leadership is, what path should we take as individuals, and what path should we cultivate as professionals to move us in the right direction? So with your permission, I will proceed in this way. Let me talk to you about the journey I've taken and how it's landed me here in Jyväskylä. I've looked at this problem in many ways, both vertically and horizontally. If you look at it vertically, maybe that icon is a little small. I was fortunate, I was blessed to be the worldwide general editor of the Encyclopedia of Management Theory, where I had an opportunity to see what theories exist in our field, borrowed, of course, and gratuitously stolen or applied from areas like psychology, sociology, history, cultural anthropology, and the like, to see what models of understanding there exist. And I also sought to ask other folks who are actually out there slugging it out. And my university is in downtown Manhattan, so folks who are working full-time, if they're using these tools, if they are using and applying them, and if they're actually working. So this is part of my journey that I've been taking. I also wanted to look at this vertically. I had an opportunity to publish and to share ideas on importance and human importance, what it means, and hey, if you've come here, we're going big, we're not wasting time, what it means to be a significant and valuable human being. And also, what this means at the cultural or global level. Had an opportunity to present in South Africa some ideas on cultural mythology and global leadership and string together some of these templates to see how they overlap. What are the preferences and strengths? What are the predilections that we have? And how can we lead both within and across cultural boundaries? This has brought me to the following journey. I was fortunate to have published the Handbook of Organizational and Managerial Wisdom, where we looked at different aspects of wisdom. See, wisdom's not a thing. That's a spoiler. Across different types of organizations. This was an edited volume. And what I'll be speaking with from today mostly is a book that was published last year. It's December, so it's still just last year, on wise leadership, a toolbox for sustainable success. So this, in a way, is a culmination of a long journey I've taken in search of understanding what wisdom is and how we can lead in a wiser way. And if you're wondering why these hexagons circle the globe, that's coming soon. Soon that will be explained. So here we are. Here we are in Jyväskylä. Here we are at the Finnish Institute for Educational Research. Here we are, and thank you, Eva, for your introduction with your support. And here we are, thanks to Päivi and Jussi and all my colleagues here who've allowed me to continue this quest. And maybe we can share some ideas going forward. It's the beginning of my sabbatical. And on this sabbatical, I've come from New York, as I mentioned, and my first stop has been Finland. You know you are the world's happiest country, yes? So I'm looking for some answers here. And I'm also, right after Finland, going to be traveling to Egypt to look for similar answers and ideas about wisdom. And after Egypt, my plan is to then go to Korea to see and look for answers there. So what an interesting tapestry, yes? What is wisdom? Let us not limit ourselves or put us in any of us, put other people or ourselves in the box. Let us truly be explorers in a figurative and literal sense. So why should you be here? Why should you invest an hour and a half of your valuable time today here? Well, let's talk about that. And if you don't agree, then after the first part, please. What do you see? What do you see in this picture? And if you are like most people, you recognize that very famous statue on the end of the hallway, yes? This is in Florence, Italy. This is the Accademia. And that, of course, is Michelangelo's David. It is glowing. It is set in front of your eyes. You are meant to go there. And if you travel to the Accademia, you see all these people running to David like they are ball bearings, and it is a very powerful magnet. And it is a race that goes to the swiftest selfie seekers. So when you are looking here and you are seeing this David and you are running, my contention to you is, you're looking in the wrong place, because wisdom is hiding in plain sight. And the epitome of wisdom, Michelangelo's masterpieces, are not necessarily the David, but these little statues that you see on the hallway, which everyone except maybe one person here is noticing. They are the very famous prisoners. They are the statues that are emerging from their sedimentary penitentiaries. They are the masterpieces trying to make their way out of the marble. You see, Michelangelo didn't put the statue in the marble. It was already there. He just removed the extraneous material. Similarly, you can't train wisdom, and you shouldn't try. Maybe some of its subcomponents, maybe at some level. You can't put wisdom into people. You need to uncover it. Educare means to draw forth in the ancient Greek. So rather than trying to be talking heads, giving people answers, I'm not here to give you answers. Sorry. I'm here to ask you wicked questions and to help you find the wisdom within and to help you unleash that, to find the kaleidoscopic you and to be able to lead sustainably. So beware when you're shown places to look. Beware of those Davids in the world, right? And if you're David, I'm sorry. But beware of those Davids in the world that scream out for your attention and look for that wisdom that's hiding in plain sight. I've asked this question so many times. And again, this was kind of the seed to my tree, the tree of wisdom, perhaps. Why do leaders fail? I mean, for 10, 20, I don't want to keep going because you'll know how old I am. Lots of years, I've asked this question, why do leaders fail? Why do they fail themselves? Why do they fail others? Why, as stewards, as trustees of our institutions and organizations, do they let us down? Well, here are some of the themes. And if you can see on the screen, if you notice my pointer here, they're not that smart. They just don't understand. They don't get it. Do you know any leaders who just don't get it? Is it you? They're not very nice. Where's their heart? Where's their energy? Where's their compassion? Have you opened up the newspaper or clicked somewhere on a news source? Can you find a leader who's not very nice? I mean, they don't have any ethics. Where's their moral compass? They'll do anything. They're like a drone. They're all about the EGO, the ego, right? They only care about themselves, and they can't see beyond their own little sphere, world, or group. They can't bring people together. They're divisive. They can't get anything done. They're all talk and no action. They're a paper tiger. They're all dribbling and not scoring and bringing it to the hoop. Or maybe since I'm in Finland, they're all skating and no shooting and scoring. These are the primary reasons I've heard why leaders fail. What do you think? Have you heard them too? Why do we have so many stupid, smart people? I mean, we live in an age where we have so much information, so much data, so much knowledge, yet we keep doing stupid things. I mean, the opposite of wisdom is what? Foolhardiness? Foolish? Why do we not get it? Why do we continue to have this problem? Why, as Harari, as he talks about in Sapiens, do we build more and more capacity, yet keep not knowing how to use that capacity well? Well, you can look for the answers as far back as Plato in his Republic, where he talked about the difference between becoming a leader and being a leader, that we don't always choose the right people. Sometimes the skills it takes to get elected or to climb the corporate ladder are not those same skills it takes to actually do the job. Maybe our selection systems are awry. Maybe we're kidding ourselves. Why is KID in capitals? It's an acronym, right? Why are we so obsessed with data and information and knowledge, or knowledge, information, data, KID, that we miss the idea of wisdom? I mean, everything is data. We are drowning in data. We are awash in information. I mean, we are overflowing with knowledge, but we're starving for wisdom. And maybe we're going backwards and not forwards in this, because we just look at what we can measure, and wisdom's hard to measure. Something more is needed, and enough is enough. How do we solve these major problems before it's too late? How do we wise up? How do we wise and shine? Sorry, I must have at least one bad pun in every lecture. So in searching for these ideas, I've scoured literatures, and where best to start than philosophia, you may have pronounced it philosophy, the love of wisdom. And these are ancient principles. I mean, millennia, right? Some people like to invent their own theories and maybe even name it after themselves, but I want to defer to folks who are way smarter than me, who have been doing this for thousands of years, and look at the common questions that are asked. As Will Durant tells us, every discipline rests on the foundation of philosophy, of deep questions. And they're all essentially the same questions. How do we think? How do we feel? Et cetera, et cetera. And when you mix philosophy with leadership, ooh, that gets interesting. Not too much math in my presentation. And Farida, if you're on, you'll appreciate my very little math here. Wisdom plus leadership is wise leadership. So how do we understand the leadership literature that's quite divisive and quite complicated? And how do we boil it down to its essence? Well, I have some ideas, and this is what I want to share with you. We better hurry up, because leaders are making a big difference. Leaders are responsible for our performance, our satisfaction, our absenteeism, our turnover, for our well-being, for our happiness, for our effectiveness. We better get moving. And as I mentioned to you, I think we're moving, just to be a little provocative, in the wrong direction. I'll show you this on a slide. And one of the things we're up against is that it's hard to measure wisdom. So instead of that, we just call other things wisdom and we measure those. You ever hear the joke about the man who's looking for his keys and someone says, well, let me help you. And he says, oh, where did you drop them? On the other side of the road. Well, why are you looking here? Well, the light's better. Sometimes we look for things where the light's better, not necessarily where they are. And when we obsess on measuring things, right, we understand that people do what's inspected, not what's expected. So we have to dare to look at complex, dynamic, fuzzy things without stripping them of their very nature. So here's my representation of where we are and where we're going. But don't worry, I'm not going to leave you depressed on this winter day. We need wisdom. I don't think I can sell that enough. I don't think it's very hard to sell. I hope I've made the argument. As the world gets more complex and interconnected, as the ramifications of our adjustments or misjudgments are amplified. But unfortunately, and again, I'm going to poke some sticks here, right? That's what I'm here to do, to ask wicked questions. We're not necessarily educating folks for wisdom. We're training, right? And this is dangerous because the past is not necessarily going to be a good predictor of the future. You know, there are major disturbances and they're happening more and more frequently. So if we rely on models of the past and we don't try and then we just talk to some of our very impressive executive MBA students yesterday and trying to predict the future, we need other ways of doing that except leaning on what's worked in the past. So we need not to cultivate memorization, but wisdom. And let's put the if teachers out there. Let's doctor heal thyself as well. Because those of you, and I hold PhD, which means doctor of philosophy, yet very rarely do people who have PhDs actually have to take a philosophy class to be doctors of philosophy. So it's interesting to think about when we need wisdom more and more, how we're on a very slippery slope, and we need to change the way we do things. We have to recognize that it's cumulative, that our combined wisdoms, capital W here, is going to be a function of what we learn or what we mislearn. Sometimes we have to, now follow me here, learn to forget. Sometimes we have to be willing to drop things that don't work, drop the lives we've planned, as Joseph Conrad says, to go to the lives that are waiting for us. So we have to kind of reconcile as we take our steps that we're either increasing or decreasing our cumulative capacity to deal with this future. Said another way, and hey, I look for an excuse to get my favorite art into every presentation. I show you Raphael's School of Athens. And you may have recognize it. It's in the Vatican. You can see the door here on the bottom left corner. And in the middle, you have a debate going on with professor and student. Do you debate with your professors? It's required in my class. But you can see this debate going on here between Plato and Aristotle. And Plato is pointing up capital T truths, absolutes. But Aristotle is saying, no. Empiricism, situation-specific truths. We have to look and see how the truth changes. It's relative. Who's right? Trick question. They're both right. That the process of experimenting and exploring the components of wisdom will give us this cumulative understanding. We have to recognize it's a process, and we have to be willing. And there's some very good research out there, and I think some people who are on this are the ones doing it, and I thank you for joining, that there's very, you know, to gradually build up our wisdom and look at its components, but not separate and not have these wars, but instead look for ways of putting them together. We've failed in many ways. We've been teaching some of these courses wrong. And I'm sorry if I remind you of one of the courses you've taken. But let's look. Have you taken a course where you've been forced to memorize people? This person did that at this time. And then what do? You spit it back on the test. And then as soon as you leave, it's gone. That's not learning. That's not even training. And it certainly is an education. You know, but that's how a lot of our textbooks are written. And it's a shame. Better approaches look at categories. Like, and this is a common one in leadership research. Is leadership universal or contingent? Is it a trait, who you are? Or is it a behavior, what you do? But then again, you have these warring factions and the students scratching their heads and leave puzzled, like, which theory should I use? Which is right? Oh, I don't know. No. If we move toward the studying of fundamental competencies organized around wisdom, we can finally bring these literatures together. They're doing it. Uh-oh, I'm about to give you one of my least favorite words in the English language. It's a three-letter word. But the way we're doing it is so narrow, is so static, is so surface. Don't worry, I'm almost done with the depressing part of the presentation soon. Let's address the elephant in the room, shall we? Do you know this expression, elephant in the room? The big issues? And this comes from one of my favorite poems. I actually read it in my classes by John Godfrey Sachs, The Blind Men and the Elephant. And if you see the truth, and the truth is the elephant, and the blind men are coming to it, don't worry, I'm including myself as someone blind in this case, you know, as a researcher. We only look at part of the elephant, and then we swear it's the whole elephant. And then we argue with everyone else who sees it differently. I stumbled into the elephant and boo, whoa, it feels like a wall. So I swear this elephant's a wall. I swear this is what wisdom is. Oh, I happened to touch the tusk. What have we here? So very round and smooth and sharp, 'tis evident the elephant is nothing but a spear. I actually remembered some of the poem. Oh, I happened to touch the squirming trunk. So I will swear that wisdom is just this part. It's a snake. I happen to touch the leg. It feels like a tree, right? I know what a tree is, so I swear wisdom is a tree. And I'm going to fight with anyone who says it's like a wall or a spear or a snake. Wisdom is a fan, and Sorry, I should have gotten a better picture of the elephant. Seizing the tail that swings within your scope. You think that the elephant is a rope. And this is the problem that we've been facing. You know, we have all these folks coming from all these disciplines, philosophy, psychology, a lot of psychologists studying wisdom. Unfortunately, sometimes wisdom is defined in what they know, just the happy ends of all these psychological scales, or historians, or et cetera, et cetera. We have to be willing to see more of the elephant and put it together. Have I convinced you? We have to go bigger? Good, so let's do that. Let's kind of go bigger. Let's be willing to look at what wisdom is in the big picture. Let's work our way toward a solution, towards getting the leaders we need. The approach I took, and I'm going to speak about this in a different talk, I think it's in 2 weeks, is to borrow from theoretical physics and the idea of M theory, and also from old basic map making and cartography. And if you have any knowledge of theoretical physics, I have a little, just enough to make me dangerous. The idea of M theory is the M isn't magical or mysterious. The M is, if you will, mega or multiple or meta. The idea here is that all the theories we have, okay, they're true in their area, given their conditions and constraints and all their caterus paribus. And other theories are true in their areas. So like M theory stitches together different pictures, like you might do on your camera when taking a panorama. It's essentially photo stitching, but in 5 or 6 or 7 different dimensions, it gets kind of wild. So if you take a lesson from the physicists who are looking for TOE, theory of everything, we can stitch together our theories without losing the richness within each theory's domain, but not losing the forest for the trees. In doing this, I will tell you the end of the book right now. We are able to arrive at meta-monitoring skills and develop our mega heuristics to understand what theory we need, and theories are tools, in what situation, and to use those theories appropriately. And what I've gleaned and what I've done on my journey is kind of do this. And the result are 3 dialectics. Do you know dialectics? Where they seem to be opposite, but not so much. And if you kind of look for the higher truths, it's kind of neat. So here are the 3 dialectics I will walk with you through for the rest of this talk. Logic and aesthetics. Head and heart. How to think like a leader and how to feel like a leader. Not or, and. Inside and outside. How to look deep inside yourself, like in ethics. And how to look far beyond yourself, as metaphysics aids us in doing. How to pull people together, as social epistemology describes. And to push people forward in politic. I don't mean lowercase p politics, so let's get that and move it to the side right now. I mean polis, getting things done. You can tell I've worked with some people from Los Angeles, because lights, camera, action came up. Lights, being stronger, increasing the luminosity of our lights, of our head and our hearts. Camera, seeing deep inside ourselves, daring to reflect and to look far beyond ourselves. That type of camera. And doing, action, pulling and pushing. These are the essential competencies of leaders. These are also the reasons why leaders fail. Let's discuss. When we do this, we will see that lowercase w wisdoms, as I've teased, will come together in a big wisdom. When we do this, we will see that we get all the tools in our toolbox for doing the job, and we can teach better and learn better what wisdom is. And if we dare, we will develop the attitude and the aptitude, the alacrity and the fluidity, the will and the skill, so we are willing to be those people, not one-trick ponies, and we are willing to change who we are if needed. This framework reconciles leadership research. This framework, and it's really cool because I've subjected this to so many different tests, some of which were looking at Time Magazine's most influential people in history, and it explains why people are on that list. It also explains why 90-something percent of the people on that list only are there once, one and done, because they can't change. They're one-trick ponies who happened to fit the situation. They're not sustainable, but that's a talk I'm doing in 2 weeks about sustainability. It also reconciles the greatest leaders we could think of, we can conceive of in our imagination. You know, as Professor Einstein tells us, imagination is more important than knowledge. So I looked at the American Film Institute's greatest heroes in that we can possibly conceive. And it makes sense it is too. And it makes sense for the practitioners of leadership who actually lead. It gives us those tools. For the educators, it gives us those means. And for the theorists, it helps us understand the problem a little better. So let's talk about it. Here's my idea. Here's what I've developed so far. Here's where I'm willing to start the conversation. What are the essential elements of wise leadership? We need to know how to think. Leadership logic, using your head, as the proverbial scientist in the lab coat, perhaps, to address sagacity-related challenges. These are challenges that are cognitive in nature. They are about thinking and understanding. We need to be scientists when we need to understand better. And we need to also be artists. Yeah, I'm a business professor talking about being an artist. Using your heart to address emotion, spirit, affective challenges that involve feeling and maybe intrinsic inspiration. Can you be a scientist? Can you be an artist? We need to kind of recognize these are timeless, essential characteristics of the wise leader. They are not either or. Those are false choices. They're canards. Logic and aesthetics. It also involves seeing, as I've teased. There is a leadership ethic. And not just the little thing we're required to do in our class at the end or on the side, but really digging in. Not just can you do something, but should you? Looking deep inside yourself as a proverbial icon to address character-related challenges, it breaks to a very important word, integrity, about morality and principles. Do you know leaders who are not principled, who fail because of this? How do you teach it? You can't train it. How do you educate for it? You need to look deep inside. You know what I'm going to say next, right? And look far beyond yourself. Ooh, metaphysics. Look far outside yourself as an advocate to find purpose and meaning and mission or significance. I just talked about this briefly yesterday, that so many of our students, so many of the people in our workforce are quitting because they don't see meaning and mission in their work. And if you are in the newer generation, younger than me, more hair than me, maybe this is more important to you even. Is it important to you that you care about what you're doing? How do you teach people to see beyond themselves? How do you get people, and I love movies, to connect the intimate with the infinite? And there must be a leadership epistemology. We need to connect to understand and develop common language and ways of knowing. We need to be able to pull people together as the proverbial maestro, to unify, integrate, coordinate, and connect. Do you know leaders who fail because they can't bring people together? And we need to get people to push people forward. Pushing as the pervert in politics is what teaches to address value-related execution challenges, do things efficiently and effectively. Some of you may have majors in this area. These are the essential tools of the wise leader. It's not my model. I'm merely the conduit. This is the essential wisdom of the ages. Apply to almost any discipline, and if we dare to see the big picture and bring them together, we can actually do so. And you can see how I have organized it. Ooh, and now you see why I had all those hexagons circling the globe on that book cover. And you can use this almost as a dashboard in your car. One thing I've noticed in Finland is many of you have smart watches. So imagine having a watch with this on it, and different pieces would light up depending on what the challenge was, and you knew who to be. Wouldn't it be cool? You know, can you use your head as a leadership sign? Uh-oh, it's an understanding problem. No, it's a feeling problem. And again, this is an issue of ethics. Come on, don't overthink this, right? This is a metaphysics. Hey, we need some meaning here, not more technical talk. Right? Epistemology and politics. I was fortunate enough to go to the film festival here on Jyväskylä's campus, and there was a really fun movie about someone who was looking for beauty, but all they were doing was overthinking it and missing all the beauty around them. I get no money if you see the movie, the Trouble with Nature, but it was just about looking for beauty and missing it because all the person could do was think and do logic. Did you ever do this in beautiful Finnish nature? Not really appreciate it? So this is kind of an integrated model of wise leadership. And it's a path I propose we can take to develop the leaders we need. Maybe even ourselves, if we have any leaders out there. So let me ask you some really wicked questions. I'm going to make you uncomfortable now, I hope. How sharp are your tools? How sharp are your tools? Rate yourself. Are you strong as a scientist or not so much? Or, I need better tools. How are you as an artist? How are you at inspiring? How are you in ethics and having deep-seated principles? How are you in meaning and vision and purpose? Can you pull people together? Oh, yeah, kinda, or not so much. And getting things done. If you fill this table out, you can develop your profile, your snapshot. And you can guess I like doing this with my students. So you can do it right now. Or maybe after you see this, shortly after. Put a check in each of these boxes. String them together. And you've developed what you have going right now and what you need. And don't be like those people who go to the gym with really big arms and chests and all they do is work them out and they have skinny little legs that they never exercise. Be the person who dares to work on your weakness. How sharp are your tools, folks? And how apt are your tools? Just because you have a nice toolbox doesn't mean you use it well. I had a really nice toolbox when I had my house, and I didn't always use the tools the right way. So just because you have the tools doesn't mean you always use them. So do you match the tools to the right job? And do our leaders do this? And I already mentioned example before. Are you a leadership scientist who only thinks one way? So we have an understanding. Okay, I can help you. We have an issue of energy. Oh, more science. We have a moral problem. More science. And it's the answer is more science for everything. And they never solve the problem. Can you have the tools and use them well? Because look what happens when you don't. What if we need meaning and purpose and leaders don't supply it? Someone else will. And they'll go astray. Take, for example, and I've done some studies of this, cultic groups who, when people are looking for meaning and it's not supplied, they supply pernicious mismeaning. And they'll bring people together in bad ways. And if we don't have leaders who are willing to supply this, then we put ourselves at risk of other people who are willing to do it for us in ways that aren't so good. So how strong are your tools and how apt are your tools? Did I give you enough to think about? Good, but I'm not done yet. Yes, you want me to be. Did you hear we have a pandemic? I heard this. It was somewhere in the news. Tell me whether you think. Please. Well, and again, if you're, you know, tell yourself. What kind of wise leadership do we need during the pandemic? Are there any problems here where leaders need to understand? Or is any of our leadership failing because our leaders are not understanding the science and the issues? Yeah? I can feel the air of your yeses, at least figuratively. Do we need leaders with heart during the pandemic? Ones who care? Ones who can motivate us, inspire us, overcome fear, promote love and promote feeling and care for those who, you know, who are affected by it? Yep. Do we need leaders who have ethics and morals and principles? Are there ethical aspects to the pandemic? You know what the answers are to all these, right? I would say yes, but since I'm in Finland, yep. Metaphysics, what are the aspects, leaders-to-be, of the pandemic about meaning and mission and purpose? Why are we here as a society? Why do we exist as people? Where do we really want to go? Are leaders failing because they're not showing us the right vision? Are people pulling us together, or is this pandemic dividing us into camps, to tribes, to warring factions? Are people getting things done? Or is it, as someone way wiser than me might say, a lot of blah, blah, blah? I think you know who I'm talking about. We need to actually get things done. Take a look. How would you approach the pandemic from this perspective? Educators, how could you teach the skills so leaders of the future will deal with the next pandemic? This one's easy. It's like a 2 or 3 on the scale. Wait till we get a real one. Can you see the elements of wise leadership here? Can you see what we need? Yeah, it's theoretical, but it's real. I can talk as long or as short as you want on this, but I will, and again, I'm going to give a different talk where I go into this in greater depth, but I want to show you a little bit about how I've come to try and approach the teaching of this and how I see the elements of this, okay? But I have way more slides than I need, and I know Eva will tell me when to be quiet, so I will keep going until that happens. How do we teach this? How do we learn about this? Okay? The first element, look, on our watch, the logic button lit up. We have a problem of understanding. How do we teach people to understand better? Well, yeah, I have a lot of this in the book, and I argue about it this way. I propose this way. We have to give people the tools of greater comprehension, both breadth and depth, to see more and more things, and not just at the surface, but their deep-seated assumptions, so we know why things are and how things are. We need to understand our discipline. Maybe you're a psychologist, a sociologist, from business or law or medicine, but we need to know the other elements to see how we put things together, because life doesn't come in small little packages. I know at universities, I'm going off again, I'm under my soapboxes. I know in universities we divide things up into courses because that's the only way to teach them. But in life, everything happens at once. There's a sociology and a psychology, et cetera, all the time. How do we teach greater comprehension? How do we sharpen people's assessment to perceive and to do it almost unconsciously, to intuit, the intuition? Again, in Finland, a hockey example, right? You may have heard of a Canadian by the name of Wayne Gretzky. Amazing player. Wasn't the best coach, because what he did was internalize these principles that he just felt where some was going to go. Or he kind of played hockey like some of us play a video game of hockey. It was no mind, as Bruce Lee talks about. It's so much a part of him that he was able to see it and feel it, like the grand chess champion who just feels an attack coming, rather than us who memorize all these little pieces. So how can we develop that feeling? Again, my university is right by Wall Street, very close to New York Stock Exchange. I have so many students who tell me they can feel when something's happening, you know, and usually they're right. And how do we sharpen people's judgment? I mean, I'm going to give you rhetorical questions. I'm not here to tell you what the answers are. Training isn't my game, you know. I'm here to ask you wicked questions. How do we get people more rational? How do we get people to be more creative, to destroy their paradigms, to dare to do that? These are questions of intellect and prowess. So let me ask you, how will you integrate it into your pedagogy? What are the principles of good logic in your class? What learning objectives should you put on your syllabus? What outcomes should you demand? And where should you find it? For example, should you borrow from the sciences, from math, for information technology? I was at a wonderful presentation here in Uvascula on machine learning and artificial intelligence. How could I integrate that into my class on management and leadership? The science of knowing more. In my course, we spend some time, believe it or not, if you walked into my business class, the first case you would get is Plato's Republic. And then you would study some of the ideas of Einstein. And then we would actually debate how you construct an organization that has reason, that has a brain. These are cool questions. One of my mentors for one of the first books I talked to you about, his name is Paul Lawrence, talked about how you create brain-like organizations. How cool is that? Can you lead smart? Can you think? Can you approximate the intellectual and judgment part? How do we teach our students? How do we become more sage or sagacious? Uh-oh, a different light's flashing. We need to energize our people. They don't care. We need to feel. They're hurting. What do we do? How do we deal with this? Well, there are ways of teaching this. We can do this. We can kind of develop people's awareness, their sensitivity, and their empathy, empathetic viewing. I mean, some people say we're born with it. Some say we have to learn it. But how can you become more empathetic? How can you care? I remember some of my teachers had me do this. You know, they go to certain places or join certain groups and really look at different ways and care from the inside, not from some external ivory tower. How can we develop an attitude of positivity and of pluralism? And maybe I'll spend a little bit more time here. How can we truly motivate and influence folks? Not by cajoling them, not by dangling carrots of more money in front of them, but really make them believe intrinsically, right? Really want to walk through walls for a cause. Have you ever felt like that? Have you ever felt like I'd walk through walls for that person? I'll do anything for this cause. And why don't we feel like that for our organizations? Have you ever played video games all night and it's, oh my gosh, I've been doing it for 8 hours, but it felt like 8 seconds? Have you ever gone to work and 8 seconds feels like 8 hours? Why can't we develop jobs which are like video games? Why can't we kind of make them more inspiring? I'm guessing the best leaders you've ever come across were inspiring. How can you, in your course, whatever the discipline, teach folks to inspire, captivate them? My niece, one of my nieces, is training to be a teacher. And her minor is acting and theater. to kind of understand the heart and how to inspire people. I love it. And if you're out there, I know you're going to be a great teacher. How can we integrate the arts and music and literature into our classes? Speeches by Dr. King you'll encounter in my leadership class. The film of Stanley Kubrick or Steven Spielberg. You'll even get Shakespeare in my class. I mean, find someone who played the heartstrings more than Shakespeare in history. Please. How can you develop, wait for it, passionate organizations? Leading with feeling, emotion. Oh my gosh, a business professor is about to say this word. Love. How can you imbue spirit into your leadership? If the ethics light is flashing, what should we do? Here's how I go about it. Because I did promise teaching and learning implications. How can you develop a mindset for morality and moral maturity? Do you know this? Can you see elements of morality and right and wrong? Or is just right what you want and wrong what other people want? Can you develop a maturity of morality to see principles rather than just functionalities or utilities? Can you develop, and this is where another, I have so many, I'm so blessed and so lucky to have so many people who've been willing to spend a little time with me on this. Another one of my mentors talks about authenticity. Can you find your true north? Can you align yourself according to these principles? Can you practice what you preach? Have you seen this word here that begins with a T and ends with a T? This idea of trust. Do you trust your leaders? In Finland, I know there's a lot of talk about trusting your leaders. In some other countries, less so. Can you develop the esteem and agency to be good? Because let's be honest, sometimes we're not rewarded for doing the right things. John F. Kennedy wrote a book, and he won a Pulitzer Prize for it, about how people knew what was right, but if they did what was right, they wouldn't get reelected. Profiles in courage. Confucius tells us, let's go east and west, that to know what is right and not do it is cowardice. Do you know leaders who have some cowardice? How about you? Are you willing to do the right thing, even when it's hard? Even when it's not going to help your career? Can't train that. How can you in your courses cultivate moral courage? How can we borrow from schools of economics and law and social justice? They inform, they're necessary but not sufficient, because what's legal ain't always what's ethical. In my course, we draw on some of the lessons of the Buddha. We read Brothers Kasamarov by Dostoevsky, to search for ethics. And we try and develop organizations with a conscience. Can you look deep inside? Can you be authentic and moral? Can you strive for character? And we can go through some of these and call them up depending on our time. You'll let me know. Metaphysics. How do we teach people to look far outside? How can we develop? I know this is a cutesy word that sometimes is used and misused, the idea of mindfulness. But how can we teach people to understand and really appreciate where they are and how that relates in terms of perspective to overarching things? I mean, our planet's very small in comparison to the whole universe, right? I mean, sometimes we have to understand how, and I mentioned this, our intimate relates to the infinite. How can we develop inclusiveness with regards, for example, to diversity? Now, diversity is an interesting word, right? But can you cultivate it by systematically looking at how to see diversity? And how to appreciate diversity, and how to leverage diversity. And how can you create and many of you may know Abraham Maslow and his five levels of his prepotent hierarchy, but at the end of his life, he talked about another level, transcendence, going beyond the self. How can we cultivate an attitude of service? I'm going to say something to you now that may or may not be controversial. You can tell I'm not afraid to be controversial. Does the leader work for their people or do the people work for their leader? The idea of servant leadership is that a leader doesn't think of themselves as being above everyone, but rather they exist to serve those folks who've trusted in them, you know, to the best of their ability. In my view, I think servant leadership is redundant. How can we cultivate a mind of service? How can you show people the big picture in your course, how your course and your class relates to every other course and class that they may take? How can we integrate lessons of history, of cultural anthropology, of religion, of spirituality? In my classes, and I promise some specific examples, we talk about Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce Native American tribe and how their views of the universe were different than maybe some others, of Mohandas Gandhi, and seeing things a little differently, looking far outside. And let me touch on the last ones briefly, and too many good things to talk about. And then we can go back as you see appropriate. How do you teach people to pull together? How do you teach complementarity? Bringing folks together, not necessarily who are the best athletes, but who are the best team players. How do you teach good communication? Not just accurate, but supportive. Not just conveying information, but forming real bonds and forming partnerships where every conflict isn't a blood sport and it's a zero-sum game in the arena of I win, you lose. I win more, you lose more. How can we, in the tritest of ways, but the most profound and meaningful of objectives and aspirations, strive for win-win? And how can we create the structure and the culture to bring people together? How do we design our schools, our organizations, our classes to bring people together with the right amount of differentiation, but also integration? How do we create cultures that esteem this? And I would challenge you the same way. And I will share with you that I draw heavily from theories of communication, from sociology, and yeah, from sport, from team. Group and team don't mean the same thing. We call them sports teams, but some of them are more groups than teams. And I'm not talking about any in specific. I've been to a bunch of hockey games here so far. I don't think I should be allowed to go to any more because every time I go to a game, our team loses. But is there a difference between being a group of people and being a true team? Yeah, you bet. In my class, we talk about Queen Elizabeth I and how brilliantly she cultivated this culture and spirit of teamwork, about Nelson Mandela. I mean, I remember standing in Robben Island, right, at his cell and thinking about what he saw, about the division he saw and how he was able to overcome. How can you create organizations that work together and not against each other? Pull people together. And with regard to politics, well, now we're getting into the nitty-gritty of some of the business schools. How do we cultivate excellence and advantage in our operations and innovation? How to create sustainability. As I mentioned, that's going to be a future talk, so I won't go into it too much here. But how do we create the attitude of learning? How do we leave our students hungrier, not sated? I remember doing a talk, and it was on an Erasmus grant, and it was in Lyon, France. And I talked to one student, and this is what we came up with. Tell me if you like it. That every, you know how you walk into your room for a class and then you walk out when you're done? Well, this was the challenge we came up that he agreed to. Every time he walks out of a room, he'll be stronger than when he walked in it. How do we cultivate that idea? And in my class, you know, we draw from many of business and political science. We talk about Master Sun and Sun Tzu. We talk about, Niccolo Machiavelli. And we talk about not just being inspiring, but pragmatic, to push people forward. So this is one way we can start thinking about becoming wiser in our leadership and developing wiser leaders. Taken together, and I'm hitting the time exactly where I want to be, go figure. What I've talked about with you today, they're all complementary. You don't have to choose one or the other. They all go together in their own space. And you can't just be one and expect to last. You have to be able to know what's needed and use the right tool for the right job. And all of these lessons are dynamic. They change when you go to different countries. Do you think I'm going to encounter the same leadership paradigms in New York City, one of my earlier slides, and Finland, and Egypt, and Korea? Do you think the leadership of the next generation of AI will be the same as leadership when I was starting out teaching with chalks and blackboards? Do you all know what chalks and blackboards are? Have you seen one in a museum? These change, and we have to be able to adapt to what changes in technology. Man, I should have asked this with more time left. Does technology make us wiser? What I'm encouraging you to do is to hopefully want to do this, develop the will, and then go out and do it. You know, be a good diagnostician. Be flexible. Have your meta heuristics and your mega competencies. And as I promised some of our hosts, and I'm happy to do, some of the ways we've done it, or I've tried to do it in my life, are through cross-functional learning communities. For example, teaching two classes back-to-back in business, where you take a class in law and a class in philosophy, and you consider the same exact case study from a legal and a philosophic perspective. We want to put these courses together so you can see things in different ways. Community engagement and internships. Get out of the classroom and see how messy it is in real life. I know if you're working right now, you've already seen it, right? We make things artificially neat here. We have to, right? But to see how messy they blend together, I require all of my leadership students to go volunteering in the community, community service, and use their tools and see how hard it is. And not just talk about what Gandhi would do, but to do maybe some of it. And global field studies. I've taken my students all over the world. I've been to Finland, took my students to Finland and Russia to study national competitiveness, to Israel to study entrepreneurship and innovation, to Brazil to study sustainability, to India to study cultural differences, to China to study different paradigms. I mean, all over the world, to really go there and live in these environments and see how rich and complex and, quite honestly, how fun it is to lead across cultures. To do this in your classes, and teachers, if you're out there, to test and assess according to these ways. How can we assess our students, not just in logic, and that's too many of our courses. Do you know this? Good. Do you know that? Good. But how do you test in other ways? I actually challenge my students to solve world problems. Like, and set up these conference tables of advisors from different fields and address these really messy problems. I challenge my students to develop personal development plans through coaching and set specific goals and objectives, and we measure them as they take action throughout the course. And at the end, we assess how far they've gone, development. And testing is interesting, too. Do you get tests in your classes? Do you get tests every week? Would you like a test twice every class? I try to be the least popular professor in my school, perhaps, because I started testing people twice every class. Once when they came in to see what they knew, then I'd lecture, then I'd test them again to see what they learned. It's interesting. They didn't like me at first, but toward the end they saw it. And if you really want to grow, that's kind of cool. In summary, I hope I've made this worth your time to consider these big issues, shown you the problem, shown how we've tried to get there, and showed you why a solution isn't easy. Hey, if it was easy, we'd have done it already. I've shown you a little bit about this model, gleaned from the greatest minds of history that have been true in every civilization of our construction, every era of our existence, head and heart, in looking deep in and looking far out, and pulling and pushing. And I hope I've communicated with you, though a little quicker, because we're only here for a little over an hour, some of the issues regarding curriculum, pedagogy, and some examples you might think of. So again, wisdom is not a destination. It's a journey. If anyone tells you they're wise, that's profoundly unwise. Wisdom is a process, and it's integrative. It's dynamic. And it's inexorably intertwined with our social existence. It's shared. So I'm not here telling you I have it. I'm just confessing I'm an explorer with you. And as Will Durant tells, I'm warmed by your company as we go through this journey. And you know how I'm going to end this, right? Thank you. I give the floor back to you, Eva.
Thank you so much for this inspirational lecture. Are there any questions here? Okay, there.
I was just wondering what different kinds of leadership you anticipate to find on your travels as you come now to Finland and then go on to Egypt and Korea. What are you hoping to find?
Before you hand the microphone back, let me take Professor Prerogative. Do you think I'll find different leadership patterns?
Well, I'm trying to answer the question without just saying yes. I think that it would be very disappointing if you did not.
Yeah, I mean, if we kind of think about that one picture of Plato and Aristotle, right, that there are some truths, and I do believe there are some elements of a wisdom that we're looking for. But no doubt it takes different forms, right? In some ways, we're all climbing up the same mountain, but in different paths. And we have to, because the topography is different. So we do need different tools, maybe in New York and Uvascula and Cairo or wherever, right? So you should see some variations. You should also see variations because we have different cultures, right? And we have different institutions. So you should see different variations, and leaders should be comfortable doing that. And that, you know, it's interesting because a book and exploration, I looked at the mythology of Egypt and the mythology of U.S. to see how we really connect, right? So I fully expect to see different variations and ilks of these common themes. You know, we're going to see a striving, right, for understanding the world. If I'm humble enough to defer enough, I'm not going to come here just talking, but more listening. and learn a lot from you and Jyväskylä in Finland about how to understand better, right? So I fully expect, I guess I should, this is the professor talking way too long, sorry. I fully expect many different leadership styles and approaches, but I so dearly hope that they'll all be revolving around these common themes. And maybe, just maybe, we can find a way to learn from each other. You know? Does that make sense? Yeah. Thank you for the question.
Any other questions?
All right, from the business school, excellent. Yeah.
Thanks for the excellent presentation. This question is actually slightly built on to the previous one. I was just wondering about the context where the manager or leader operates. And you started off the presentation by throwing a question that why do leaders perhaps fail? And I was just thinking that quite often leaders perhaps fail not because of their flawed or there's something wrong with them, but instead quite often also good leaders fail, for example, as a CEO. So might it be that the context influences quite a lot? So you just might be the wrong person in the wrong place at the wrong time. So you might get, for example, fired as a CEO, but then the same chairman of the board might, after a couple of years, hire you back into another company. So I was just thinking that, of course, the context might be radically different in New York or in Finland or in Egypt, but it might be also in the same company within a 2 or 3 year time span. So the question is that, is it part of the wisdom as a leader also to recognize the context, a kind of a situational availability of where you operate, in addition to being kind of balanced inside?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. I'll answer that in three ways, of course. You've heard of a man named Steve Jobs, of course, who built Apple and then was fired from Apple and then was asked to come back to Apple. You've heard of a man maybe by the name of Winston Churchill, who was not well regarded in England, and the same day Mr. Hitler came to power, Mr. Churchill came to power, then he was not elected. Then they wanted him back, right? Yeah, so a lot of times the situation dictates what the dominant need is for our leader, right? You know I'm going to quote a movie, too. Sometimes in The Godfather, we need a wartime consigliere. So sometimes we need a certain person who has that dominant characteristic for the dominant problem, right? That's in the case that the leader can't adjust. They know their stuff, but they can't become that wartime consigliere. Or Steve Jobs maybe doesn't want to, maybe he probably could have, become that manager versus leader, right? So that's a function, yeah, and there's a theory called strategic contingency theory in business, which says that whoever gets power in the organization is the person who dresses the dominant uncertainty in the environment, like Lee Iacocca in Chrysler. We need a marketing guy. You know, so yeah, sometimes it's because we are in that box, whether because of skill or will, and then the environment changes. So we're not a good fit. We're the round hole and it's a square peg now, you know. You can last, right? You can change with the time, but it's really hard. I guess the second thing I'd say, because context is so important, is that sometimes good leaders aren't rewarded for being good leaders, right? As Plato and others talk about, you know, the leader who sees, and this is the parable of the ship and the ship and the captain. Sometimes the captain who sees the stars and the big horizons is seen as a useless stargazer, right? And I'm sure some of you are either very or precursory of familiarity, right, with Plato's cave. That folks who actually see reality are ridiculed by those who like to play their shadow games. So sometimes we reward the wrong type of thing. So sometimes we just don't get the leaders we really need, but the ones we deserve. You know, that goes back to another conversation between two people I've had the pleasure of working with, you know, a little bit, you know, whether leaders should be authentic, as Bill George speaks of. Or Jeff Efford, hey, you gotta get in there and you gotta do it, right? It's a lot of leadership BS, as well. I think the title of his book, So, yeah, you absolutely have to adjust to the context. And sometimes the context won't reward good behavior. You know, and that means, as a business professor, you certainly know, right? We have to build organizations that reward good leadership, to build societies that good people can get elected. Sometimes we don't. It's a shame on us. We got to do better. Thank you for your
question. Yeah, thanks for the answer.
Yeah. Oh, I know you have a question, Eva, yes?
Oh, yes.
You probably have 12 right now.
No. I think I know a lot about wisdom theories and models. And about Eric's model, it's one of the rare models which has been traced from philosophy. So I think it's quite unique in itself. The other models I know, they are psychological or sociological models. And I like your critique of these models or those theories which have been created, or wisdom. But I have one question. You stressed that wisdom can't be trained, but at the same time you talk about education.
Yeah.
Is there any kind of paradox or...
Well, there's always...
What do you mean? What do you mean by training and education?
Yeah, well, thank you for that. Yeah, I mean, there's always good paradox in any search for wisdom. Training typically has the connotation, at least, that you're putting something into someone else, right? That you're training. It's like you're executing an algorithm. Education, at least in the broader sense, is seeing the big picture and cultivating those skills. So yes, there is some training to be done at the micro level. I mean, there are things you can train on in terms of certain computer skills, right, or technical knowledge. But training for wisdom is like chasing the wind, you know. You can develop the skills, but in the context of wisdom, at least in my view, right, that who are we to try and put this into someone else? That the job of a professor, at least as I see my job, is not to give you things, right, but to help you become and realize, right, everything you need for your personal and professional success. I'm more of a facilitator. So that's how I approach it as well. And maybe it mixes, and I do know a little bit about some of the, you know, the work that you do, right, in terms of Socratic dialogue, you know? And if you don't see her, she's nodding right now, yeah, to kind of help people see those contradictions, you know, those... You know, rubbing up against life and seeing those difficult issues, and then from that, us growing internally. Yeah. So training has a level. Maybe you should do your training at the 100 level when you first become freshman, but if you're training at the 400 level or the graduate level or the PhD level, maybe we should talk. But thank you for that. Yeah, do you want?
Thank you for the questions and answers.
Yeah, I wish you all the best on your explorations, you know, for your personal and professional success. And I look forward to hearing about your journeys. Kitos. Thank you. Goodbye.